Welcome to the Reboot Republic podcast. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host and alter ego, Tony Groves. Tony, we're joined today by Leilana Farah, the former UN rapporteur and now global director of The Shift. We're delighted to have her with us. Leilani, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good, good. How are you finding your new role?
Busier than I had hoped. I don't think COVID helps at all, obviously.
It's possible to actually be busier than you were as rapporteur.
Maybe not busier, but certainly almost as busy. And it's that's unfortunate. I actually really do need to take some time off, I have to say. But I want to say it's a real pleasure to be back with you guys. I think it's been a few months at least.
It has been. And we're really delighted. And we do want to start by saying thank you so much for your time as rapporteur. You were great with us and globally. And I know a lot of people are really, really, you know, appreciative of the work you did. You really trailblazed around housing and financialization and with the movie The Push, but all the documents you produced as well, we're constantly using them in my courses. And I know people in campaigning are using them around the right to housing. So I really, really wanted to say thank you for that and well done.
What's up? Labor of love, and a big labor, I will say that, but it was a labor of love, really. And I'm super happy that people are finding the work that I produced in the mandate useful, because that's a whole point. I rely on people who are working on the ground to inform my work, and then I hope my work would then inform the work on the ground, you know, so like a big circle. We start with the work on the ground. People on the ground identify what the rights violations are, what the struggles are. I write reports that then help in those struggles. That's the idea. So you've confirmed that maybe, at least for some folks in Ireland, that happened. So that's cool.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Certainly ruffled feathers of some people who needed their feathers ruffled. Let's put it that way.
And that's always a good thing.
Yeah.
that is definitely true. And you were speaking there just towards the end, sort of wrapping up around kind of, I suppose, your reflections on your term, and maybe you could tell us like kind of what were they kind of short before we go on to talk about COVID, which you will, of course, and what's the new context for housing and your role. But in terms of your role as rapporteur, kind of what were your reflections on that time and kind of what you saw as housing and the right to housing and your experience and lessons?
Yeah, well, when I first started as rapporteur, I realized quite quickly that there was and is a global housing crisis that wasn't being talked about very much, and certainly not talked about as a crisis. I mean, everywhere I went, it was clear people were really struggling in cities, not able to pay the rent, homelessness, you know, flourishing, even in the most, in fact, in particular, in some of the most affluent countries. So there was like this dissonance between, you know, wealth and the reality for so many families and individuals. But there wasn't a sense, unlike climate action stuff, there wasn't a sense that this was a crisis worthy of media coverage, worthy of significant government attention. So I set out to do something about that and found a lot of people who wanted to join me in that. And a lot of people were verifying what I was trying to put out there. And that's the people who were engaged in local struggles. And so, and then I found allies in many, not all, cities, city governments, who are really at the front line saying, like, we don't know what to do about this housing crisis, or totally unaware of the big financial actors and their impact on the cities, or unaware of the relationship between their interaction with big global financial actors and the implications for housing and homelessness. So when I think back, it was like a lot of it was hunch, and like I had a hunch that I should do this. And I'm really happy that it sort of took off, because now I think we're in a different place. And I think with COVID hitting, which we'll talk about, we're in an entirely different place than we were 8 years ago or 6 years ago in the case of my mandate, where different conversations are possible. There's a complete awareness right now of what the housing crisis means in terms of COVID and what COVID means in terms of a housing crisis. Mm. So when I reflect, I'm really happy for the work because I think I helped contribute to us being in the best place possible to address housing disadvantage in the face of this horrible virus. One thing I also realized at the end of my mandate is I never had a theory of change, and maybe I was supposed to have a theory of change. It makes me laugh when I think about that. But so because I didn't have a theory, I just sort of worked really hard. And that's not a bad theory of change, actually. Work with as many actors as you can, as hard as you can, and you just might achieve something. How's that?
I think you had quite a clear theory of change, which was about social justice and the right housing.
Can I come in for a second? I want to say, also echo Rory's earlier sentiments of saying thank you so much for the work you do, but I also want to go back and say, and even if it was just to bring it back and digest it to its simplest form, I remember you telling me when we first met that the path to human dignity led through your own front door, and I think that message was always something that you championed and still continued to champion. And I think when you think about it, as you say, we moved on to COVID and we talk about where that's done. The other key aspect that you did is you even introduced in many ways to other people the term financialization, mm-hmm. and how this was the biggest market in the world. It wasn't the stock market, it was the property market. Have you found that the lexicon and the terminology and that people use now, we are more accepting of those terms than at the beginning of when you started your mandate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I myself didn't even know the term financialization when I became rapporteur, and that was a steep learning curve for me. It predates the film Push. Mm. I wrote a report on financialization, as you know, and then later Push came out. Definitely people are talking about this phenomenon in a way that they weren't. And what's most amazing to me is that governments are talking about this, and they absolutely were not talking about this 6 years ago. And so if I had a hand in that, fantastic. The thing is, it's not just financialization. I'm finding there's actually an appetite for a human rights response to financialization. And so there are a lot of urban geographers and sociologists who've been talking about financialization for a long time, and I've learned from them. I'm deeply indebted to them. What they didn't do, because that wasn't their frame, was they didn't put their work, that body of work, in a human rights framework. And I think I've helped to do that. I think others have done that as well. I think my predecessor, Raquel Rolnick, did that to some degree as well. And I think that's an important shift, because it's one thing to talk about financialization. We need to figure out who's accountable and who's accountable to whom. And it's the human rights frame that provides accountability, because we have the right to adequate housing, and that actually means something. Mm. It means, for example, that housing has to be affordable, and affordable based on household income, not based on what the market can bear. And so without that human rights lens, you don't get that. Well, what's wrong with financialization? Well, what's wrong with it is we have this notion of the right to housing. Governments have committed to it, and yet financialization destroys some of the key elements of adequate housing. For example, affordability. For example, security of tenure, right? A lot of people very worried about their ability to hang on to their unit when their unit becomes financialized, a part of a financial product, and rents go up and then they won't be able to afford it. That's threatened security of tenure, a cornerstone of the human right to housing. And governments have an obligation to make sure that doesn't happen. So the human rights frame is what I think is so important about financialization, and even that is catching on. Mm. It's not catching on quite as much as just the notion of financialization. So that's the next step, and that's part of what I'll be doing with the shift, is really bringing home what it means using a human rights frame.
So in terms of that, then your role, you're now global director of the shift. Do you want to explain what is the shift again, just sure. in terms of people and what your role, where you see it going?
Yes. So the shift is the global movement to secure the right to housing. And it's a partnership with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. So the sort of highest human rights body within the UN system. And an international network of cities and local governments called UCLG, which brings together about 250,000 local governments from around the world. So I engaged them in a partnership, and really we're an international entity akin to other international organizations like Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, except we're focused very squarely on the right to housing and securing the right to housing. And we have as our kind of vision the idea that housing is home and not a commodity. And that's a sort of central driving idea of the shift. We're hoping to do a whole bunch of different things, including, you know, straightforward research and analysis, because this is still an underexplored area, the idea of financialization and human rights. We want to, when the pandemic is over, it will end. It will end. And we're able to travel again. We would like to do fact-finding visits to cities in particular to help local groups get a handle on what's happening in their city from in terms of financialization and expose that to the world, and also help governments understand that they can do something about this and that they actually have an obligation to do so. So we have a whole bunch of activities in mind. We're just in the stages now that I've don't have the responsibilities of the rapporteurship, I can spend more of my time moving forward the shift. So we're, you know, doing all those things that organizations need to do, like developing a website and increasing our social media presence, et cetera. So we're in the initial stages, but I think we're going to ramp up quite quickly because COVID is forcing us to.
Yeah, and no, best of luck for that. And we're going to be watching it quite closely and supporting you. And
so.
Absolutely, in terms of that. And I think it's really significant, as you say, to develop, you know, an international organization based around the right to housing. And I think there's huge potential for that to have a real impact. And as you mentioned, COVID, I suppose the context in which, you know, we're in right now, and you came out quite, you know, strongly and quickly in the end of your role as rapporteur around COVID and you know, the calls, as people said, you framed it very well. You said, you know, in terms of the protection and people protecting themselves from COVID, it was all about staying at home. It's what government's ordered. But yet for so many people, you know, they don't have a home, or home is not secure. It's not safe. It's not habitable. And where we're at now, we've seen governments introduce incredible measures that, and in Ireland as well, that were previously said they weren't possible, like banning evictions, moratorium on evictions, freezing rents. Where do you see the housing situation now in currently where we're at, and what do you see happening in terms of COVID, do you think, and the implications?
Yeah, kind of mixed, to be honest. I know that we are meant to celebrate, in some ways, the moratorium on evictions, the housing of people living in homelessness, the deferral of mortgage payments, some rent abatements or reductions. And I do applaud all of that. I mean, I applaud it. It was necessary in the face of a deadly pandemic. Mm-hmm. So, and it's actually, in some respects, I've said to some governments, you know, don't expect me to praise you for doing what is in fact your obligations under international human rights law. I mean, so you know, check mark, good, but that's about all you're going to get from me, because I've been saying for the last 6 years that you need housing strategies based in human rights. You have to eliminate homelessness immediately. Rents are unaffordable and we need better tenant protections. Financial actors are invading the housing landscape in an unrestricted way and they need to be regulated. And so, yes, COVID exposes why I was saying that for 6 years and why my predecessors were saying it too, right? Mm-hmm. So that's all good. One of the things that worries me, well, there's a few things that worry me. One, a lot of these measures are temporary, which is unacceptable. Because, no, I mean, it's unacceptable from a human rights point of view. It's unacceptable from the point of view of the sustainable development goals, which governments now are probably going to plead that they can't meet because of the recession that's in place. But it's also... temporary measures are unacceptable from a health policy point of view. We now know that because there will be another pandemic. Mm. So you can't have people living in housing precarity and homelessness. And in the southern world in particular, without running water and access to sanitation services, et cetera. So these temporary measures are problematic insofar as they're temporary. And then... sort of even more structural and deeper, what worries me is many governments have employed the services of a big investment firm called BlackRock. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can't get away from these guys. I take aim at Blackstone for all of what they did in financializing housing. Now I have to take aim at BlackRock, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. They are advising governments in their economic stimulus packages and in formulating a response, an economic response to COVID. And I don't know what they're up to exactly. So it's early days in my own analysis, but it worries me. BlackRock is not engaged in the financialization of housing in the same way that Blackstone was, but they do have residential, real estate investment trusts that they manage and that they're part of. And real estate investment trusts, for listeners, are, they're a financial instrument used as a way to financialize housing and group housing all together. The worrisome thing about, we call them REITs, is that, first of all, REITs are owned by shareholders.
They're profit-driven.
They're totally profit driven and 90% of the profits have to go back to shareholders, which leaves this 10%.
Our listeners would be familiar with, we have a number of REITs here in Ireland.
And yes. Rory, can I come in? In some of our electoral divisions, so how we break down our boundaries in terms of going to the polls, and some of our bigger ones, in the likes of Dundrum and Tala and this, the REITs aren't just players, they are the majority of beds available. They're over 50% of some of the bed spaces available. So they are, people keep telling us in Ireland, oh, they're only a small part of the market. Only if you take Ireland as a whole, if you look in concentrations, they are absolutely huge players. They are the big player. And when they're in your area, they drive everybody else's prices up because everybody else has to compete with them. And that's where they are. Just what I want to keep referring to is the no going back and the things that can't be unseen. We have seen, as you said, these temporary measures that were taken. We've seen in Ireland, for example, we've argued here, and I know you spoke to people in Barcelona against the Airbnb and how the holiday short-term rentals were distorting the market. And we were told that they weren't a player in Ireland for the last number of years, and sure, if they disappeared, it would only take I think Rory, was it, am I right in saying Ronan Lyon said it was less than 2 weeks supply into the market? Yeah. And he's one of our foremost economists who's quoted regularly on things, and yet we still managed to have, is it 900 units come onto the market in a market that was regularly ticking over in less than 200? I mean, they may not have been all Airbnb, but they were certainly, whether it was whatever the other name we put on these companies.
Yeah.
Do you think that these are the solutions that we talked about before this are undeniable now? You know, we have to look at these things and regulate them really strongly.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's so COVID is horrible and has made all of our lives poorer in so many ways. But it has exposed some real truths. And that's the contradiction of COVID, in my opinion, because on the one hand, it's like nothing existed before COVID. There's that feeling, nothing existed before COVID. Mm-hmm. And yet what COVID actually has done is it has revealed exactly what existed before COVID, especially in the housing world, right? And I think you're absolutely right that there should be no going back. I think it's very complicated for governments to see that. Actually, what is so stark and plain to us and those of us who care about housing from the vantage point that we do is not so plain to governments who are wedded to an entire system that is very much based in the financialization of housing, in housing construction, it's a huge part of most GDPs. It's the biggest business in the world, as we already said. Mm. It is residential real estate is, the biggest sort of asset class in the world. So, for governments to go down the path that we know they need to, and that COVID exposes that they need to, is still difficult for them. I see that. I don't agree with it. Of course, I don't agree with it. I think once governments get their heads around the fact that, oh, really, we actually do need to create sustainable societies that can withstand a pandemic. Hmm. I mean, that's the question they need to be asking. So how do we create societies that can withstand another pandemic? Then the housing answers should come forward. The regulating Airbnb type platforms, short-term rentals, making sure there's enough housing stock available, making sure there is deeply affordable housing stock, social housing stock, affordable housing stock, etc. Recognizing too that I think there's going to be bigger pressures on rental housing now, right? Because people who are homeowners are going to lose their homes. Quite for certain, many will. I mean, I think governments will try to prevent that from happening, but I think many will. And where do they go? They have no choice but to go to the rental market. And so governments are going to have to buoy up the rental market. But whether governments are there yet in their thinking, I think local governments are starting to get there, but I'm not so certain enough national level governments are there yet. Mm. I think the ones that experienced extreme austerity, experienced extreme austerity after the global financial crisis might be moving in that direction. So, and I'm talking Southern Europe, I'm not talking Ireland, sadly. But I don't know. I haven't heard enough from, I like to hear from you guys, like what's your national level government saying about the way forward? Are they recognizing that these can't be temporary measures that they put in place?
They started very, give them credit, they started very well by taking a lot of necessary steps. And they have made some good decisions around rent freezes and bans on evictions, COVID payments to people who are out of work. You know, I don't want to give them credit for things that they should do. But it's not a bad thing that they've done these things. Yes. Like the deficit, I spoke to a guy in Portugal, a vice deputy leader of the Socialist Party, and he said, the deficit be damned. Whereas what we are starting to hear now, unfortunately, is that, the bill will fall due. And actually, that's economically not true. The bill won't fall due. Even as long as Europe hangs together, the rates are bloody zero. So we should just make sure we get people through this and save as many lives as possible. There's been no time limit as such, but there has been talk. There's been kites flown about, right. this yes. measure was only an emergency. Which brings us back to when you were last here, when we said, actually, after you visited, I think the Taoiseach stood up and said, yes, housing was an emergency then. So he didn't take those steps when he said it was an emergency then, and he took them in this pandemic. So, you can understand my reticence.
Yes. Yeah, I think as well, that they, you know, initially they came under a lot of pressure from organizations, housing organizations and charities and homeless organizations to put in place the rent freeze and the moratorium on evictions. And they did, banks gave a certain amount of leeway to those paying mortgages, but renters still have to pay their rent. So there's a major problem that's going to lie ahead in terms of rent arrears that have built up, which you have flagged. And the big question, we're just having a new, appears to be a new government forming, parties are in talks. And it's important to say that housing was one of the major issues in the election we had in February. And there was a very clear rejection of the previous government's housing policy, very clear rejection of that. But it seems to be that there are policies that they're putting in place in the new programme for government. We haven't seen them exactly yet, but they don't mark any radical shift. And there's no mention of a constitutional right to housing or putting in place the right to housing. So it seems that there's a bit of lip service taking place. Their initial response was good to COVID, but the danger is two things. One, that they remove the measures and we have these major problems of rent arrears and evictions that take place. And then secondly, as Tony said, absolutely rightly, there's this talk of essentially they're saying we're not going to do austerity, but neither are they going to engage in a major stimulus investment program in housing. And then thirdly, there's no kind of mention of the right to housing. So
can I just come in on the right to housing thing? They are talking. There was talk. This program for government is the most underwhelming document that I've seen in terms of the proposals that are in it. And they're talking about we'll need a referendum, but the referendum is to cap the price of land. It is not for the right to housing. And it's disingenuous, and it's giving people the idea that they're taking this step, and it's not radical at all. So it's disappointing, and I'm disappointed. But I do think Rory is right that they lost so overwhelmingly in the last election. They're cobbling together. We have civil war parties in this country for 100 years that are going to be forced together. So the change may not be this election, but it may be the next one, Rory. It would be my thought, because they now can't even put together a majority government out of the two traditional big parties aren't big enough to form a government themselves. So that's a big change.
That's disappointing for me to hear. Absolutely. And one of the ideas we have with the shift is to start opening, I don't know if we want to call them chapters, but chapters, let's call them that. Yeah. And Ireland is on our list. Absolutely. We have a shift chapter in New Zealand. And so basically an organization has established itself as really wanting to shift the conversation in New Zealand more toward the right to housing and away from its commodification, even though financialization looks different in New Zealand than it does in, let's say, Ireland. I think that Ireland is ripe for a little shift chapter.
I think that the other side of this is that, and I think the new government, when it's formed, is going to come under a lot of pressure quite quickly, because as you saw when you visited here, there's a very active civil society movement. We have, for example, the Raise the Roof Coalition, which includes the Congress of Trade Unions, the National Women's Council, our student movements. We have a new campaign, which I'm involved in, called Home for Good, which is specifically campaigning for the right to housing, which involves some of the homeless NGOs, the law centres, and people from Raise the Roof. And we have other grassroots. There's a new tenants union has just been set up. So I think that in the sense of civil society, I think is not going to let this government away without fulfilling the mandate that they were, or sorry, the sense of the policies that were demanded in the last election.
One of the things I love about the movements in Ireland that you're involved in and that you've mentioned is this going back to the basics, and I think a legislated right to housing or a constitutional right to housing, whatever makes sense in your context, is so essential. And I think the pandemic reveals that as well. Yeah. That it's not good enough to just have a smattering of mediocre policies, that there has to be an entrenched right that actually is given meaning and effect through other legislation and policies and programs. So I hope that the groups there can continue to argue for that and use the pandemic to move that forward. I do want to say one thing about international human rights law and the benefit in the stage we're in. Because Ireland took some good action when COVID hit and started to house homeless people and et cetera, ban evictions and put a moratorium in place. For Ireland to then take steps backward away from that, release people back onto the streets, allow people to be evicted into homelessness, whatever, those would be considered what we call retrogressive measures in international human rights law. In other words, they're backward steps. And that's actually considered a violation of the right to housing, to take those backward steps. Now, the caveat is they can argue austerity in their defense. But I'm not sure that that defense would hold muster against a deadly pandemic, which we know there's going to be another one. So there will be another one. You know, how many have we had in the last 15 years? We've had quite a few. And so, and I just don't think the maths are in their favor. I mean, we know that it is more economically efficient to ensure that people who are homeless are housed and to ensure that low-income people have affordable rental accommodation, because it's low-income people that give a greater proportion of their income back into the economy because they're spending their available resources on groceries and clothing and other essential services and goods. So I don't think their austerity argument could work in the face of retrogression for homeless people and people living in housing precarity. But you should know that in your the groups in Ireland should know that and keep that in their human rights toolbox, because retrogression is absolutely a violation of human rights and the right to housing.
That's right. A really, really important point to make, I think, and it's really important for us to hear that in terms of the context of that idea, because there is a lot of worry about what will happen if these measures, you know what I mean, are rescinded and when they are. And already the impacts, you know, there is talk of some people being evicted outside of the moratoriums and how they're enforced. Do you think, though, that, because I was trying to consider that, you know, given the recession that's going to happen and that mm-hmm. we're in the midst of, mm-hmm. that will demand for housing that they will reduce in a sense, and therefore, are we going to see, you know, a semi-collapse or partial collapse of the housing markets and the build-to-rent sort of sector reducing its supply? And, you know, the implications, will we see, you know, it'll be back to, or not, you know, more of the vulture types getting engaged? And so the nature of financialization is going to shift a bit. And
So... Tony is shaking his head. I'm interested.
Rory, they're dying to come in again. They are cash. They have cash reserves more than most national governments have. They are ready to go.
Tony, the question is, okay, I totally agree with you. And I mean, I have quotes. I was actually just looking for it. Quotes from Blackstone and others saying, Wall Street Journal reported this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to buy distressed assets, right? So, but my question is this. So one of the things I feel right now is if you have such a huge swath of the world's population unable to pay their rent, and a huge swath of the world's population unable to pay their mortgage, don't we have to question what market value is?
Absolutely.
Don't we have to question whether there is market value when the market is poor? Basically, everyone is poorer. And so then I ask, okay, so these guys have all this money, dry powder, as they call it. I learned this term, dry powder. Anyway.
It's always men with this stuff, by the way. It's always men.
That's right. So, what good is the dry powder if it gets invested in this distressed asset or that distressed asset, if the whole market is depressed? That's my question.
Because, and Tony would know this better than us, is because, and this is what I was saying, Tony, that there's different types of investment. Hmm. That this is the time for the vultures, the Goldman Sachs, that come in and buy up now when assets are cheap, and they can hold it because they're looking 5 years, 10 years down the line when they recoup their they recoup their money. But there's other types of build-to-rest investors, which I was talking about, who are in the middle of building huge numbers of apartments and houses here in Ireland. And I don't think they will continue. I think you will see a scale back of those projects, which raises the question, well, then who supplies housing in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years before you have this investment again, the next wave of investment? And I think that brings in the back the fundamental question, is the role of government, local government, you know, not-for-profits, affordable cooperatives, that really the big argument is that to deliver the right to housing, we need the not-for-profit and state sector building so much more homes.
I'm not arguing with that, Rory. That's exactly what we need. We need them to do that. I'm just making the point that there, as Lalani put it better than me, they've looked at this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. They did think for a number of years that they wouldn't be coming anywhere near Ireland for another few years because they thought everything had already happened. But the pandemic has just given this enthusiasm is, and I mean that in the most awful way, that for what is possible now. There are also players that are worried that, you know, the likes of the government's previous 2040 ambitions for and the rent pressure zones, because we call them rent pressure zones, if you remember, Lani, they were nothing other than upward only rent reviews. It just meant that you were going to get a 4% minimum return on your investment every year. If you said that to any investor, they'd take your hand off in a market where money is going, you know, zero interest rates out there. So all of those things are coming to the fore now, Rory. But I do think unless the state steps in, and we know we have the Land Development Agency in Ireland, we know they want to keep it off balance sheet, and unless they square that circle and it has to come off, it has to go on balance sheet and become a producer of public housing for all types of incomes, unless we go down that road, we are, I don't want to be crude, we're pissing in the wind again.
But Tony, are you suggesting that if the build to rent schemes start going under, that then government could intervene and make the, you know, help survive that project, but that the condition could be deeply affordable or social housing?
So the government have put aside money to give subsidies and grants to some of these companies. Where they're failing is they've targeted at companies that are employing, you know, over 500 people. They need to be going at the small builder who's going to employ and maybe build 15 houses and employ more people and keep money locally in the economy, not some of these other bigger industries. I mean, Orla Hegarty's architect from UCD has argued that we need to think of the Dunkirk model, loads of little boats that are doing the work as opposed to these big giant developers.
I love that image.
And I think that is the image we need to think of now. And this is the opportunity now to do that, because it's an employment driver. It helps. Good. You mentioned climate earlier. Good housing policy is good climate policy. You know, we build good houses and build them now where people need to be. Great. Like I'm just talking to Rory. You know all this stuff backwards. You both do. But I'm just, you know, when you look at it from that perspective now, there's an opportunity here, I suppose, is my main takeaway.
Yeah, I agree. Big opportunity for governments to intervene. Absolutely. Will they? I've been floating it with some finance ministers that, you know, this is a great time to build up public assets. And there's no doubt about that. I mean, why can't they exercise right of first refusal, for example, governments, that is?
Exactly. And why aren't they the ones who are buying up? Why don't they buy up the distressed assets rather than and unlike what we did with NAMA, which was buy up the distressed assets right off the debt of the developers, hold on to them, and then send them on again at discount to vultures, actually hang on to them and use them for affordable housing. I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, you guys could, maybe you are advocating for that already, but to turn NAMA into the good that it could be. I've used NAMA as a structural thing that could be actually very good in the face of a global crisis. It's just that NAMA then pivoted and did the wrong thing with the assets by putting them back out on the market. But if NAMA had just kept the assets, it's kind of an interesting national structure, isn't it?
Yeah. It did happen. Wasn't that in NAMA's foundational documents that it was given the remit that it could actually do, could act in the public interest, but it kind of chose to jump that paragraph and forget about it very quickly.
Yeah. Well, essentially government put pressure on it from quite early on, 2011 onwards. The Fine Gael led government really put pressure on that. It became to be more about trying to get recovery of the private property market rather than actually the delivery of affordable homes. And I actually write about it in a new book which is coming out. We have to give the plug in because Leilani wrote the foreword to it, which is a fantastic foreword. And the book Housing Shock is coming out on June 3rd, very, very soon. And we're going to do a launch for it on June 10th. Which Leilani has agreed very kindly
to
take part in.
Looking forward to it.
So, yeah, that's going to be fun. And I actually do talk about NAMA in that quite a lot and the different role that NAMA could have taken. Mm. So I think that's why my point was that there is a lot of lessons we can learn from how we responded in austerity with NAMA and the marketization post-2008, the lessons of, and how we're going to respond now, what we should and shouldn't do in the book.
Leilani, can I just final point for me now? This on the question on the shift itself, you've spoken about the need for this. Rory mentioned civic society and wider groups. When this website is up, do we foresee some sort of resource for people can look to, regardless of where you are? This is where we want to be. You want to be some sort of hub that will offer support and help to these organizations wherever we are in the world.
Absolutely. And our website's already up and running and people can go there, leave their contact details so we can be in touch when we start engaging in future actions. It's maketheshift.org. So it's super easy. Maketheshift.org. There's a resource page already set up. One of the things we're looking to do is to help groups in different parts of the world come together and realize and recognize that they have similar issues together on some of those issues. We have an action coming up that we're going to do on homelessness. So I will be in touch with you guys about that as we get closer to that. It's about COVID and homelessness, and it will absolutely have an impact on Ireland. So I'm hoping some groups like those that Rory mentioned earlier might join in our global action. So great, I'll tell you more about that when we're just pulling it together. So end of this week.
Sounds good and sounds really important. There's a lot of work needed around that. Leilani, thanks so much for joining us. And
a
really,
pleasure
really
as always.
Wish you the best of luck in your new role. And I know you're going to have as big and bigger impact than you had even as a rapporteur and continue to have great influence. Thank you.
But keep inviting me back. I love these conversations. They're my favorite.
Thanks, guys.
We do too.
Thanks for listening, folks. Again, these podcasts rely on listeners. Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. We're putting them out there. Price of a cup of coffee helps us keep going, especially through these times. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.